Okay, if you have not already, if you want to grab your Bibles and go to Daniel chapter 11, as you turn there, just a couple brief reminders and review of where we have been in this study. The book of Daniel is a favorite book of many folks, or at least it has many of the favorite stories that we think about in the Old Testament. But when you think about the book of Daniel, you probably think about the first half of the book of Daniel more than you think about the second half of the book of Daniel. You think about Daniel, you think about the dreams that Nebuchadnezzar had and Daniel interpreting those dreams. You think about Daniel and the lion's den and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You think about the handwriting on the wall, all of those great stories in the first six chapters. But those last six chapters are not as familiar to us. One, because we haven't studied them as often as we have the first six chapters. Two, because they are more difficult to understand. Those first six chapters are really easy to grasp essentially what's going on. You get to the last six chapters. And these last six chapters are prophetic in their very nature. They are looking towards the future. Daniel is seeing visions in chapter 7 through 12. He is relaying those visions to the Jews is initially, and then to us, but relaying those visions to the Jews of future events. There were times when Daniel was overwhelmed, and he basically passed out, as it were. He was just so overwhelmed by what he was seeing and what the Lord was revealing to him. He asked for understanding. He asked for interpretation, and often the Lord provided that for him. Sometimes that interpretation is a little easier for us to grasp than at other times. But the things that Daniel saw in his visions had a lot to do with four major world empires: the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, and the Roman Empire, which also corresponded with the four empires that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream in Daniel chapter 2. And so Daniel was focused on events that were going to impact the Jews. That's what he is. He's a Jew. That's his people who are in captivity. They are the Jews. Those are the people he's concerned about because they are in captivity, his Jewish family. And so that's what the book of Daniel focuses on, is the future of the Jews and what was going to happen to them, and ultimately what God had in store with sending Jesus to save the world, to establish His kingdom, which is the focus of that image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2, was the establishment of not a kingdom that would come like the Babylonian kingdom or Medo-Persian or Greece or Rome, not an earthly kingdom that would come and go or pass away, but a heavenly kingdom that the Lord would establish here and that would be here forever, as Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44 said. And so Daniel has seen visions in these last six chapters that especially have to do with those four world empires. And what we're seeing in Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12, these last three chapters are one unit. Many times up to this point, each chapter can almost stand on its own. But you get to these last three chapters, they are one unit. It is one vision that Daniel is seeing and is being conveyed to him. And these things have specifically to do, especially you'll see in the beginning of chapter 11 and verse 2, has to do with the Persian Empire and the kings that would reign over the Persian Empire. But you get to the end of verse 2, and the last word I have in verse 2 is Greece. And that's the remainder of the chapter, is focusing on the Grecian Empire. You know that Alexander the Great came along and in just a short amount of time conquered the known world at that time. But Alexander died at the very young age of 33 and did not have an heir for his kingdom to be given to. And so instead, in 323 B.C., his kingdom was divided essentially over a period of years among four generals. And obviously that was in various geographical regions, but the main two generals and the main two geographical regions that we focus on for the purpose of that Daniel's focusing on is what's called the Seleucids, after Seleucus, one of his generals, and the Ptolemies down in the south, after one of his generals named Ptolemy. And the reason we focus on those, the reason Daniel focuses on those, is because those are the ones that have specifically to do with God's people right there in Palestine. The Seleucids had that region of Syria up north of Palestine, and the Ptolemies had that region in Egypt south of Palestine. And as we saw last week, in the first 20 verses of chapter 11, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies were at war constantly with each other. Well, guess who's stuck in the middle? That's God's people. They're stuck in the middle. And so when the Seleucids want to go down and battle against Egypt, or when Egypt and the Ptolemies want to go up and battle against Seleucids, God's people are right there in the middle. They're continually being conquered by one or the other and dealing with all sorts of trauma as a result. And so we studied last week chapter 10, first 20 verses of chapter 11, and we saw a number of times where it talked about the king of the north, the king of the south, the king of the north, the king of the south. And what Daniel was providing for us in those first 20 verses of chapter 11, what he was providing for us was kind of an overview of, let me throw up a couple lines. This is what we had for at least for an outline for last week. What we see in those first 20 verses was this series of wars that went back and forth between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And as a result of these wars, this went on for about 150 years. Remember, Alexander dies 323. When we get to verse 21 of chapter 11, we are being introduced. His name is not there, but from history we know this to be the case. In chapter 11 and verse 21, we're introduced to Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. Antiochus came along and reigned from 175 to 164 B.C. Alexander the Great dies 323 B.C. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes comes along to reign in 175 B.C. You've got 150 years. 150 years are those first 20 verses of those battles back and forth between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Here's what's interesting. Alexander the Great dies 323. Antiochus comes along 175. When is Daniel living? When is this vision? If you back up to chapter 10 and verse 1, where this vision begins, chapter 10 and verse 1 says this is happening in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. The first year of Cyrus was 539. That's when they conquered the Babylonians in 539 B.C. The third year would be 536 B.C. So in 536 B.C., Daniel is seeing a vision of things that were going to happen more than 200 years later for Alexander, more than 300 years later, 360 years later, when you get down to Antiochus the IV in 175 B.C. He is seeing things 200, 300, 360 years down in the future, crystal clear. We mentioned and we introduced this book 10 weeks ago that there are a number of critics that want to say that the book of Daniel was written about 150 B.C. And they want to say it was written in 150 B.C. because they look at the book of Daniel as a book that was being written after these events happened. That a historian was just sitting down and writing about, oh, this happened and this happened and this happened, because of the detail that's in here. And when you were here last week, maybe I overwhelmed you too much with giving you all the names of the king of the north, king of the south, but it is a historical document, except it's not. It's historically accurate, but it was not written as a historical document, meaning it was not written after these events happened. It was written hundreds of years before they happened. And if you don't believe in God and you don't believe in biblical prophecy, you don't believe in the inspiration of the Bible, that's challenging. But guess what the book of Daniel proves? The book of Daniel proves that Daniel didn't have a clue what he was talking about, but God did. How did Daniel get all of these details right? How in the 6th century B.C. was he writing about things in detail that would not happen for 200 or 300 years, and they happened, every single one of them, down to how did he know all of that? He didn't. God did. If you want one of the greatest proofs for the inspiration of the Bible, it is fulfilled prophecy, and this is one of the greatest books to see a lot of that, especially when you get down into the detail of it. And so when you get to the middle of chapter 11, we get down to verse 21, and we are reading about a man by the name of Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, and I believe that the first 20 verses of chapter 11 are there simply to get us to verse 21. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes was one of the worst rulers that ever came into the lives of God's people. Again, he's in the Seleucid line. He is a ruler of that northern area of Syria. And so look with me in verse 21, where it says, "And in his place," this is talking about, and I think I've got on the screen, this is talking about Seleucus the fourth, the ruler we're reading about in verse 20. "But in his place, after he's done," and that's actually his brother, Seleucus was actually, Seleucus the fourth was actually Antiochus's older brother. "In his place shall arise a vile person." Who's that? Antiochus the fourth, Epiphanes. "Shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty." What does that mean? Well, he came along, and Antiochus the fourth was not the rightful heir to the throne. We mentioned last week that in a battle with Rome, 14 years prior to this verse in verse 21, in a battle with Rome back up in about verses 16 and 17 of this chapter, Antiochus the fourth was actually taken away as a prisoner of war to Rome. His father was called Antiochus the third, the great. His father was the ruler of the Seleucids at that time. Romans took Antiochus the fourth away. He was a prisoner of war for 14 years, and now he comes back and he takes the throne after his brother dies. But he's not the rightful heir, and that's what verse 4, that's what verse 21 is saying. To whom they will not give the honor of royalty. It was not his to be had. But the verse says, "He shall come in peaceably, and he shall seize the kingdom by," what's the last word you have in your verse? Intrigue. Or you have the word flatteries. Go back to chapter 8. Hold your finger in chapter 11. If you've been in this class, you may be thinking, I've heard this name Antiochus the fourth before, and you have. Go back to chapter 8, where Daniel saw a vision. And this vision was in about 551 B.C., so about 15 years before the vision we're reading about in chapter 11. In chapter 8, Daniel sees a vision of a ram and what many have called a he-goat, because that's what the older translations called the goat in verse 5. The New King James in verse 5 calls it a male goat. But get down to verse 8. And what Daniel is seeing, the male goat in this in this vision is the kingdom of Greece, and you see that as you read through this. The ram in this was Persia, but here we're talking about Greece as the male goat. Look in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 8. "Therefore the male goat," Greece, "grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken." What's that talking about? If you go back up and read about what happens with the male goat in verse 5, how he spread all over without touching the ground, the end of verse 5 says the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Who was the notable horn? Who was the notable ruler of Greece? Well, that's Alexander the Great. So when verse 8 says the large horn was broken, that's talking about Alexander the Great. When he died, in his place four notable ones came up. Again, the four generals of Alexander the Great became the rulers of the various parts of his kingdom. Verse 9, "Out of one of them," out of one of the four notable horns, "a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land of Palestine." Who's this? This is Antiochus the fourth, Epiphanes. What did he do in verse 10? "It grew up to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and some of the stars." We talked then when we were in chapter 8, that's talking about God's people, how he cast them down to the ground and trampled on them. Verse 11, "He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host." He exalted himself as high as God himself. "And by him," by Antiochus the fourth, "the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of God's sanctuary was cast down." We read about this in chapter 8. I want you to see it again, because we're going to see it in chapter 11. Go later in chapter 8, where Daniel is being given the interpretation, verse 23, where Daniel was given the interpretation about the little horn. Verse 23 says, "In the latter time of their kingdom," the Greek kingdom, "when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise." That's Antiochus the fourth. That's the little horn. "Having fierce features, who understands," what? "Sinister schemes." How did he come into power? It wasn't rightfully his. But through sinister schemes, he came into power. Verse 24, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. That's talking about the fact that God gave it to him. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people, the Jews, through his cunning. Notice, sinister schemes in verse 23, cunning in verse 25. He shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. He shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against God himself, the Prince of Princes, and he shall be broken without human beings. That's how he would die. And so, back 15 years earlier, Daniel saw a vision that had to do with Antiochus IV. Now, come back to chapter 11, he's seeing a vision again about this man, but it's even more troubling to see what he does to God's people. And that's the real focus of this whole section and what's happening with these historical events is what is happening to God's people through Antiochus. Look, let's go back to chapter 11, verse 22. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. That may be talking about one of the priests. The priesthood, by the way, when you've got all these battles going on between the north and the south, when you've got the Jews being taken into captivity and coming back from captivity, when you've got them continually being conquered by the Greeks and then by the Romans, the priesthood sort of became up to the highest bidder. They were no longer following the priesthood where a descendant of Aaron was the high priest. The priesthood became kind of a situation for bribery, kind of the highest bidder situation. And sometimes one of the kings would put somebody in charge as the high priest. And that's probably what's being talked about in verse 22. Verse 23, after the league or an alliance is made, here's how he would operate. Remember what we saw about him in chapter 8. He was deceitful. He was cunning. He was an individual who understood sinister schemes. Verse 23, Antiochus would get involved in an alliance or a league, and he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He would enter into these nations. He would enter into an agreement with them. He would enter into an alliance with them, and then he'd come along and conquer them when they were least expecting it. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably, talking about these alliances, even into the richest places of the province. He'd come in and take all of their treasure. He shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. What did he do? He dispersed a lot of his plunder to his troops. The spoil and the riches, he'd give it out to his troops. This is just from history, things that we understand about what he did, even his supporters. He would devote it to his gods. Verse 24 says, he shall devise his plans against the strongholds. But look at the end of verse 24. But only for a time. What does that tell the Jews? What is that letting the Jews know? This guy is coming along and he's going to do whatever he wants. This guy is coming along and he's deceitful. He's cunning. He is going to come along and he's going to take control, but what? Only for a time. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. Well, who's the king of the south at that time? At that time, the king of the south is Ptolemy VI. He's going to stir up his power against the king of the south. Again, Antiochus is the king of the north, king of the Seleucids up in Syria. Again, he's coming down to do battle against Egypt, and he's got to come through Palestine to do that. This is around 169 B.C. He comes down with a great army. This verse 25 says, the king of the south stirred up battle with a very great and mighty army, so he's ready. Ptolemy VI is ready to go to battle with him, but he can't stand against him. For they will devise plans, even some of Ptolemy's rulers and some of his advisors plotted against him. Verse 26 talks about that, about his advisors. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies, they're going to destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down. And so Antiochus comes down to do battle. The Seleucids come down to do battle against Ptolemy. Ptolemy's ready for him, but he's kind of betrayed by his own followers and by his own advisors. And so verse 27 talks about an attempt at diplomacy between Antiochus in the north and Ptolemy VI in the south. But these kings, remember, I'm giving you names because we know them. They're not in Daniel chapter 11 as you read it because Daniel didn't know those names. These names are not names for another 350 years. But the detail here, we know it to be fitting into these names because of the precision with which Daniel prophesied. Verse 27 says, both of these kings, talking about Antiochus the IV and Ptolemy the VI, north and south, both of these kings shall be bent on evil. They got together and they were getting together to try to come to some terms, but whenever they do that, Antiochus wants his way. He wants to come and get control and power over the Ptolemies. Well, Ptolemy meets with him because he wants to gain full control of Egypt back over because his brother had actually taken over part of it. But what actually ends up happening is that Antiochus sets up Ptolemy kind of as a puppet king down in the south, but they're both bent on evil. They shall speak lies at the same table. They sit down at a table to come to terms, but they can't even be honest with each other. Can you imagine politicians? Never mind. But it shall not prosper. Their attempts are not going to work. For the end will still be at the appointed time. Who's in control here? Not Antiochus, not Ptolemy. God is in control. Antiochus, the end of verse 24, these things would only happen for a time. And there would come an appointed time, the end of verse 27. God is in control. God is at work in what's happening here. And so Antiochus, where he's king of the north, he comes down to try to deal with king of the south, and they can't come to terms. They're bent on evil. They lie to each other. It does not prosper. Well, if Antiochus is going to go back home, where does he have to go? He's got to go back through Palestine. That's verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, against God's people there in Palestine, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. Again, this is about 169 B.C. when he comes through and he loots the temple and takes back many of the sacred vessels, the gold and the silver from the temple, a number of the costly treasures that would have been there, killed a number of the Jews in the process. By the way, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, I think when we were talking about Antiochus back in chapter 8. There are a couple books that are not inspired books. Some people believe them to be inspired. They are not inspired as you read them, and even the authors would not have claimed to be inspired. But there are a couple books that you can read that are called 1st and 2nd Maccabees. You may have heard of those books. They're in the apocryphal section of many study Bibles. But the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees are books that were written of the historical events, not inspired books, but written of the historical events that happened in between the Testaments, in between the end of the Old Testament, beginning of the New Testament. Well, that's where we are. Daniel chapter 11 is talking about what's happening in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and talking about the events of the Jews and what's transpiring to them. The Maccabean family were Jews who were determined, the more that Antiochus came and fought against them, they finally decided they were going to fight back, and we're going to see more about them as we read through this. So verse 29, Antiochus has been going back and forth with going north and south in his dealings with the Egyptians and the Ptolemies down in the south, but now the persecution against the Jews seems to really ramp up when you get to verse 29. At the appointed time, again, the Lord's providence is at work here. His plan is at work. Why would God be allowing the Jews to be suffering and being punished? Well, it's because of their sinful ways that this was happening. But at the appointed time, he, Antiochus the IV, he shall return and go toward the south again. But it shall not be like it was before. Because when this time, this is 2 years later, about 168, the end of December of 168 B.C., he gets down to Egypt again, but it's not like it was before, verse 6 or verse 30, for ships from Cyprus, or your Bible might say Kittim, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. He got down to Egypt, he got down to the mouth of the Nile River, and Roman ships come from Cyprus, and they come up against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved, disheartened, and return in rage. Well, if he's come down to Egypt, if he's going back home, where does he got to go again? Right back through the Holy Land. Well, now he's going back and he's mad and he's enraged because he's been pushed back again and now by the Romans and their navy. And so he returns in rage and fury against the Holy Covenant to do damage. He's going back home, but he's going to do even more damage to what's happening there in Palestine. And so the middle of verse 30? So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Hey. You want to turn against your God and come and fight with me? I will show you honor. I will give you reward if you will do that. If you'll turn against your God, and so forces, verse 31, forces shall be mustered by him. And what are they going to do? Here's we saw this back in chapter 8. They shall defile the sanctuary. About 168 B.C. They came and robbed the temple again of the treasures that were there. They shall, verse 31, take away the daily sacrifices. The Jews were no longer able to come to the altar of burnt offering to offer their burnt offerings on a daily basis. They did that every morning and every evening, as you know. But Antiochus IV wipes that out and says, no, that's not going to happen anymore. He suppresses the Jews. Any Jew that was found with a copy of God's word was put to death. Circumcision was no longer permitted. Any Jew that was practicing Jewish feast days was put to death. And so he comes along, and when verse 21 calls him a vile person, that is not an understatement. He was doing everything he could to wipe out the Jewish religion, to wipe out the Jewish culture, to Hellenize them by persecuting them, to make them adapt to the Grecian culture and to get rid of their Jewish ways. And so as you read through this, it's again, this is 350 years before it ever happens. But he comes along and destroys the temple. He wipes out the daily sacrifices. The end of verse 31 says, and he set up a place for the he placed there the abomination of desolation. We read something similar to that back in chapter 9. This is a different occasion and a different event. But Antiochus comes along, goes into the temple, and there was a place where you would honor and worship God, and he sets up an altar there in the temple to honor and worship Zeus. And so he actually named the temple, God's temple. He named it the Temple of Zeus and set up an image there in order to be able to worship Zeus. And so verse 32 says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, again, God's people who would turn against God, he shall corrupt with flattery. He says, hey, come over here and serve with me. But, you see the word but in verse 32? But the people who know their God, the people who serve their God, people who trust their God, shall be strong and carry out great exploits. This may be talking about the Maccabees. They stood up against Antiochus IV. They started a revolt against him because he was set on destroying the Jews entirely. And the Maccabean family determined, no, we're not going to let that happen. And so Mattathias Maccabeus and his sons set out to push back against, and they were outnumbered, they were outgunned, they were outmanned. Can we say any other? They didn't have a hope, except they did with God. Verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many. These Jewish leaders, these Maccabean leaders come along, and they're telling the people. If you read the history of the Maccabees, they came along and were preaching to the Jews. You guys need to repent. You need to get yourselves right with the Lord. You need to come back and return to God. And it's interesting to read about the Maccabees. Here was Antiochus. He killed more than 40,000 Jews. He enslaved another 40,000 Jews. Here come the Maccabees along, and they tell the Jews, you need to repent, you need to return to God, but they didn't put up with any foolishness. And so the Maccabees, that family, they would actually punish the Jews who were not following the law of God. And that's what he's saying here, I think, in verse 33. The people, they shall instruct many. They're telling them what they need to do to get right with God. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plundering. Antiochus is killing them. They're standing up for God and for the law, for their covenant, but they're falling, they're dying. Verse 34, when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. Not a lot, but they get a little help, and one of the reasons they get some is that many shall join them in hypocrisy, because they don't want to be punished by the Maccabees, so they come along and, well, okay, we'll join you. And some of those of understanding, verse 35, shall fall. Why are some of these who are wise and understanding and trying to be on the right side, why will they fall? He gives us the reason in verse 35, to refine them, to purify them, to make them white and spotless, to purify God's people until the time of the end. I know sometimes we read that expression, the time of the end, in the Bible, and we think, oh, that's talking about the end of time when Jesus comes back the second time. That's not the context here. If you go back to chapter 8 and verse 17, we saw that same expression when Daniel saw that vision, where it referred to the time of the end. And we talked about in chapter 8, and we need to talk about here in chapter 11, that you got to put that expression in its context. The time of the end in chapter 8 is the same time of the end here in chapter 11 and verse 35. It's talking about the end of these hostilities against the Jews. It's talking about the end of this persecution that Antiochus is bringing against them. The end of verse 35 says, because it is still for the appointed time. That's the third time we've seen that here. The end of verse 24, it's only for a time. The end of verse 27, it's going to happen at the appointed time. And now here at the end of verse 35, it's still for the appointed time. God is in control of what's happening here. And they needed to trust what was happening, that God was going to see them through this. Get to verse 36, and we read about Antiochus further deifying himself, if you want to use that terminology. His name was Antiochus the Fourth. He called himself Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. And if you read a name, or if you read a word after that, that's just kind of their title. He called himself Epiphanes, the manifest one, the illustrious one. He presented himself as a god. That's what he saw himself as. Of course, we mentioned a couple weeks ago that the people didn't call him Epiphanes, at least behind his back. They called him Epimanes, which meant madman, because he was nuts. He was crazy. So he comes along, verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. He's not just as good as every god. He's above, in his mind, above every god. He speaks blasphemies against the God of gods. So he prices himself above every god, and he says, I'm better than even the God of gods. And he shall prosper. In my Bible, after the word prosper, I've got the word till. It's limited. God's in control. He shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. They are being punished. Sin has consequences. But when God deemed the time that his wrath had fulfilled its purpose, then Antiochus would be done away with. The end of verse 36 says, For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, talking about Apollo, or the desire of women, which may be another reference to another god, Adonis, which was the goddess of beauty and desire. He doesn't have regard for any god, verse 37 says. He shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place, he shall honor a god of fortresses. He's determined, and this is talking about Zeus probably, and a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god. What's the strongest fortresses? Verse 38 says, he honored a god, lowercase g, of fortresses. If he was talking about some other lowercase fortresses, what would be the strongest fortresses that he would act against? I think this is talking about his attacks against Jerusalem and his attacks against the temple with a foreign god. And verse 39 says, he gives honor and acknowledges those who give honor and acknowledge him. And he makes them rulers over many. He divides the land. He promotes and he gives prizes and to those who follow after him. But to those who would not, and the Jews in particular, he was bent on destroying them and wiping them out. When you get to verse 40, and I know this is a lot to take in today. When you get to verse 40, it's a little difficult to know the chronology when you get to these last verses of the chapter. It's probably a good possibility that this is just maybe just an overview, a summation of Antiochus's rule and what he did. Verse 40 says, at the time of the end, again, put it in the context, the end of this persecution against the Jews, the king of the south, the Ptolemies in Egypt, shall attack him, Antiochus. King of the north, Antiochus, shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, Palestine. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape his hand. Who's going to escape from him? Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Well, why were they left out? If you read history, you find out that those were the nations who supported his army. When they were attacking Judah, those Edom and Moab and Ammon were there on the east side of the Jordan, and they supported. And so history tells us they supported him. The Bible tells us they escaped from the wrath. Again, the detail of the prophecy. He shall, verse 42, he shall stretch his hand out against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans to the west of Egypt, the Ethiopians to the south of Egypt. He's taking over this whole land. But, verse 44, news from the east and the north. So the south and the west, he's down there, he's conquering Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia, but he gets word from the east and the north. Perhaps from history we learn about Parthia and Armenia, that there were some revolts that were happening there. He learns news from the east and the north about trouble, so he goes out there with great fury to destroy and annihilate them. Verse 45, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas at the glorious holy mountain. He set up shop there to deal with and to continue to persecute the Jews. But look at the end of the verse. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Antiochus was successful at destroying Jerusalem, at desecrating the temple, but time would come, and that time would pass. And that's the message that Daniel was trying to deliver to the Jews, is that this will come to an end. It is going to be horrible. It is going to be one of the worst persecutions ever, but it will come to an end. Look in chapter 12. And again, chapters 10, 11, and 12 are just one unit. They're one vision. Chapter 12 begins at that time. At what time? Well, at the end of Antiochus. The last part of the chapter 11 says, yet he shall come to his end. That's what we're reading about in chapter 12. At that time. You may read some commentaries. Let me mention this. You may read some commentaries on the book of Daniel and read a lot about the Antichrist. That is a favorite topic of your denominational friends, your premillennial friends, is the Antichrist. And they want to find the Antichrist in the book of Daniel. And therefore, if they can find the Antichrist, they see the Antichrist is that one who's going to come before the second coming of Jesus in their minds. It's not true, because that's not what the Bible teaches. But they've made up this doctrine about the Antichrist coming right before Jesus comes back the second time. And so they want Daniel to be talking about that. Jesus hadn't even come the first time, and they want Daniel to be focusing on that. So they want that the whole focus here to be about the Antichrist. It doesn't fit. Perhaps, and if this is not talking about Antiochus in these closing verses, there are others who have suggested that this is talking about AD 70 and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, and there may be some things that may seem to fit there, but this the whole flow here does not seem to transition away from Antiochus the Fourth, and so that's why I think it's continuing to talk about him. Chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, at the end of Antiochus's reign, Michael, the archangel, the guardian angel, as we've seen from chapter 10, sort of the guardian angel of the Jews, he shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the Jews, the sons of your people, And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation. This trouble, this persecution is going to be horrible even to that time. And at that time, focus again on at that time, your people shall be delivered. This is going to be a horrible time of trouble and tribulation. But when Antiochus is gone, God's people will be delivered. Everyone who is found written in the book. If you are a follower of God, then God is going to deliver you and take care of you. Verse 2 is an interesting verse. Many of those who sleep, in the dust of the earth, not talking about their souls being asleep, but their bodies being asleep, they're dead. Those who are asleep and dead in the earth shall awake. Some will come to everlasting life. Some will come to shame and everlasting contempt. What's that talking about? Is that talking about the end of time? Is that talking about the resurrection of all people? That seems to be what that's talking about. There are some who've said, no, it can't be talking about the resurrection because Daniel's dealing with the time of Antiochus the Fourth. It can't be talking about the resurrection. That's thousands of years later. Well, the people who died at the hands of Antiochus, do they have just as much hope of a resurrection as you and I do? They're just as dead as anybody else who has died since that time. What are they awaiting? The resurrection. They want the resurrection unto life just as much as we do. So it's not unusual. The Old Testament doesn't talk a whole lot about the bodily resurrection, but it's not unusual that it might be talking about that. Others have seen that, well, maybe it's not talking about the resurrection. Maybe it's like Ezekiel 37, where Ezekiel saw the valley of dry bones that came back to life and were resurrected. And that was a vision of Israel coming back to life and being raised out of Babylonian captivity. I don't know if it's figurative. It seems to fit more that these are individuals that all are going to be raised. And it's what Jesus said, the hour is coming which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Some to the resurrection of life, some to the resurrection of condemnation. That's what he's talking about. Those who are wise, verse 3, we got to go quick here. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the remnant. Those who are raised, they turn many to righteous. They're going to shine like stars of heaven. But you, Daniel, shut up the words of this book. You're done writing, all right? You need to preserve it. You need to protect it. So seal the book up until the time of the end. Not the end of the world, but until the time of the end that's being discussed in this book. Until the time of the end of this persecution that's coming against God's people. And that way, when the time comes, many people can run to and fro and their knowledge can increase. When people 300 years later read the book of Daniel, would their knowledge increase? Would their faith increase? That's what he's, seal it up, preserve it so that people can read this 300 years later and see God at work. Daniel in verse 5 sees two angels standing on either side of the Tigris. He sees either, we saw this back in chapter 10, he either sees an angel of high rank or maybe it's Christ in verse 6 above the river. And the question is asked, how long is this going to last? And the one above the river said it's going to last in at the end of verse 7 for a time, times, and half a time. We don't have time to discuss that, unfortunately. We talked about that back in chapter 7. So go back and listen to what we talked about back in chapter 7. But the whole point of time, times, and half a time, you read about that in the book of Revelation 2. It is a horrific time of persecution, but is a limited time. And so verse 9, Daniel is told that the time is going to come. He needs to close up the book. He needs to seal it up. People are going to die, but that's so that that others can be purified and made white and refined. In verse 10, the wicked are going to keep on doing wickedly. You can't change that. But the wise will continue to serve. Verse 11, the daily sacrifice is going to be taken away. That's what Antiochus did. He put up a temple or an altar of Zeus inside the temple, the abomination of desolation that was there. Verse 12, I want you to look at this. Blessed is he who waits. They were going to undergo a severe persecution, and God says, here's a beatitude, blessed is he who waits, who endures what is happening and waits until all of this passes, and when that time comes, they will receive their reward. God wanted Daniel to know that God was in charge. Let God take care of what's happening. Let God take care of the persecution that you are enduring. It is out of your control, but it is not out of God's control. The whole focus of the book of Daniel is that God is in control. In control of the nations and what was happening, and in control of watching over and preserving and delivering His people. And that's what we see in this last vision of the book of Daniel. Thank you all very much for your good attention. I know this is a lot to take in. I would encourage you to continue to study it and to dig into it and enjoy studying God's Word.